Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
We are burning down the house on the Heritage Radio Network, episode 127, 20th January 2013. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Today I want to speak with Robert Lamb Hart, who is an architect and urban planner, who came to my attention because of a series of essays that he's been posting and is still working on in Metropolis Magazine's Point of View. Are you with us? Mr. Hart.
Yeah, Curtis, I'm here.
Hi, may I call you Bob?
Yeah, please do.
Hi, Bob. You have had a very interesting career, and Bob and I spoke a little bit previously this week, and you are of the generation before me that had the experience of having studied with the real masters. You were a student of Grope at Harvard, were you not?
That's right. Gropius and I left the same year at Harvard. He was active in teaching a master's class there, and of course, he brought his Architects Collaborative architects to as our instructors. Because of the Bauhaus background, he kind of set that atmosphere in the school, which was pretty interesting. I mean, the thing that interested me was he expected us to design everything, anything, buildings, landscapes, graphics, industrial design products, as the Bauhaus did.
That's a very refreshing point of view, given today's students who are so deeply immersed in computer-driven form-making, to put your attention on every aspect of the built environment. That's really great. So did you become an expert in designing doorknobs also?
Well, it made me much more aware of doorknobs. And in fact, our structures, our instructor in instructional engineering frequently took us on walks around, on materials. I mean, really took us on walks around the campus to study materials firsthand, to turn doorknobs. Mm-hmm. And get the feel of what it meant, what the form of the doorknob meant in your hand.
Right, and I infer from what I've read, and we'll get into that in some depth, that the direct experience of humans in what really is present is something that is very important to you. And I see here that, from what you've just said, that came in part out of your training.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We were trained at the built environment is all one, and with the natural environment, the way you experience architecture is in a natural environment, in a landscape, in a town. You can't really separate your experience of those elements, and I think that's a real loss in what I've seen of the younger people coming out of school that I've interviewed for my firm.
Yes,
I've got to tell you though that we also were being brainwashed about space, time, and the Bauhaus style. It took me a long time to recover from that.
Oh, so well. I guess Siegfried Gideon's Space, Time, and Architecture was had just come out at about that time, isn't that right?
Exactly, Curtis. It's a wonderful book, it's full of great ideas and observations and history, and it had just come out, and of course we all took that much more seriously, or as seriously as I think architects are taking Derrida and those guys now.
Yes, Jacques Derrida and the promotion of the idea of deconstructing architectural thought based on the ideas of deconstructing language. And we know who the chief culprit of deconstructivism is in architecture. But I don't really want to talk about Peter Eisenman. I want to talk about you and your experience. And I'm glad that we got to talk a little bit about Siegfried Gideon, because I think his influence has been somewhat lost. I mean, if we go back and we look at the experience of the Bauhaus, there's not a lot of manifesto making that came out of Gropius's term there, or even Mies, aside from the works of the students and the masters themselves. Wouldn't you agree?
Not quite. No, he did write manifestos. They were written in a language that translated into kind of turgid English. And so it had a hard time. And also he invited other professors who were articulating manifestos, tended to be his friends from Germany, friends, colleagues. And their language didn't translate very well. So while there were a lot of people issuing manifestos, you know, you read Tom Wolfe's From Bauhaus to Our House.
Right.
Lots of shouting from the mountaintop or ivory towers. We didn't get a lot of that except the direct Bauhaus methods, which is just the point you're making, the methods as opposed to the manifestos.
Yeah, yeah. To place this in a sort of a historical context, not to place you as a historical figure necessarily. I mean, you're still practicing, right?
Yeah, well, I'm still a principal in the firm of Hart Howerton, and I every now and then they ask me to pontificate.
Well, that's an appropriate role.
I still work with some clients that I work with for many years.
And uh-huh. All right. So you're somewhat younger than Louis Kahn, I would guess, by maybe 20 years or so.
So Louis Kahn was at Penn when I was there.
Oh, really?
I was there as a graduate student in planning, sort of 10 years after I started practicing. It must have been about 30 or 31 then, and I guess he could have been 20 years older. Yeah, he could have been 20 years older, yes.
Well, I asked because a lot of the observations that you've made, or themes, it seems, in your search for a new humanism resonates for me a lot with what Louis Kahn wrote and lectured about and explored in his own practice. I was just looking at his American Institute of Architects 1971 gold medal speech that was titled "The Room, the Street, and Human Agreement."
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that a lot of the themes that you are interested in exploring and bringing again to a new generation of architects, or the rising cohort of future architects, to bear has a lot to do with a lot of the same ideas, if not sentiments, of Louis Kahn. So I think that's kind of interesting.
Well, I'm a great admirer of Kahn's work, and of the way he talked about architecture. I quote him throughout this series of essays. I quote him a number of times. But starting with, he said, "What will be has always been." And, of course, that's one of the principal themes of my essays, which is that there is a human nature that we need to discover. Human nature that underlies the creation of cultures and the creation of our own sort of personal ambitions. There's some biology back there, and if we can understand that biology, what has always been, we can learn a lot more about the people we're designing for and how they'll respond to the things we design for them.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. One of the emerging areas of inquiry, or I don't know if it's emerging, but certainly I think architects are taking it more seriously, is environmental psychology.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, what I define as what we should be studying, what I define as a new humanism, is learning from the current, really fast-moving, cutting-edge sciences that have to do with the study of evolution, neuropsychology, I guess you could say evolutionary psychology, and ecology. Ecology in the full sense of the word. I mean, us and our environments,
right?
Because we are so, you know, shaped so much by environments. Ecology in the literal sense of the word, which means the relationships, interrelationships of an organism and its environment. And, of course, that includes us.
Yeah, of course. I've read through your essays that you've posted so far, and I identify a few themes. And I just wanted to just go through quickly my extra or abstract of your themes, because I think some of these I'd like to talk with you a little bit more in depth. You start out with a contemporary knowledge of the biological foundations of experience. That would be environmental psychology or neuropsychology. Then you deal a little bit with what I would call, what you call primal human values, and I would put that more in the basket of Darwinism. And you treat some of these themes with some extensive discussion about survival. And then another theme that you seem interested in is to advance by cooperating, which I think of in sort of Rousseauian, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, a topic for pondering. What is human nature? Is it by inherent nature, or is it by societal nurturing? Then you further then in part five, you talk about refuge, which for me is to a certain degree a poetical or almost philosophical approach to looking at what we have crafted, and we could come back to that perhaps. And then, of course, you do mention E.O. Wilson, who coined the phrase that's much in vogue these days, biophilia, which is, to my mind, a small part of true ecology. Let's take just a very brief musical break. I'd like to come back and start with ecology and biophilia and see what you think about some of the current trends.
Okay.
Welcome back. This is Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. We're speaking with Robert Lamb Hart. Bob Hart has written some essays and is continuing to put out essays on Metropolis Magazine's Point of View blog online. Let's talk about true ecology, biophilia, place of humans in the natural world. We first talked about your experience of being taught to be aware as a design student, to be aware of in my own words, I would say that everything counts.
Okay, I would take a step back, though, to address that, and that is that our origins, the origins of the human animal, the human nature, are in the evolution, and we evolved in a natural world. Evolution of the human animal, I mean, including all the stages that got us up to Homo sapiens, where we are now, we evolved in nature, in a natural world. And ecology is about that natural world and our relationship to it, our relationships with it. And that's not something that we can erase from ourselves. That's there. And and the idea of the current ideas I hear frequently of development and the ecology, or people and human activities and the ecology, is just nonsense. I mean, we are in the thick of it. So I interpret biophilia in those terms. That yeah, that's who we are.
You are well. Yeah, we're animals. We have certain animalistic behaviors. I had mentioned this when I spoke with you before airtime, but I haven't talked about this on this program. Those of you who are architects or young intern architects will know of this firm. It's a Norwegian-American firm, Snøhetta. Named after the tallest mountain in Norway, which, by the way, is also where Valhalla is. Valhalla is inside Snøhetta. And Craig Dykers, the American partner of Snøhetta, gave a little chat about a week ago here in New York City, where he talked about his design approach to public space, which was influenced very... definitely by the study of cattle movements by Dr. Temple Grandin. Those of you who listen to other programs here on Heritage Radio Network will have heard Temple Grandin in this very studio talking about how she has studied cattle so that they are comfortable in the stockyard, with the idea of if an animal, before it is necessarily, since it's raised for food, slaughtered. If it's a happy animal before it's slaughtered, then the food will have a higher food value. Now, Craig Dykers has taken this to studying how people move through spaces, and he has discovered certain things, such as impediments encourage people to bunch together and flow around them instead of just simply going in straight lines from point A to point B, and encourage people to slow down and interact. And that's just one of the aspects of things that he has studied. So I only mention that in support, Bob, of your reminding us that we're part of the ecology just the same as the birds and all the other living creatures, and also the growing plant creatures.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, we have a hard time talking about architecture and built environments without using analogies with or the language of the natural world. Growth and recycling and flows of energy and so on. I think that Temple Grandin's work is fascinating, you're absolutely right that matches what I'm trying to get us all to be educated about. The first part of the first few essays are about how those characteristics emerged out of the way we evolved, starting with survival of the fittest, or rather survival a reproduction of the fittest, which is the, you know, probably the best description of the course of evolution. But I think if we, unless we go back to those fundamentals, I think we're not going to understand human beings. I mean, survival, winning, prosperity, looking for prosperity, I mean, that's our everyday life. And it's in the heart of the designs of the built environment.
Bob, do you think that that ever in the misty past of architectural history, there was a time when the makers of structure really got it right in terms of crafting the built environment more in tune with human nature?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think there are periods and certainly many individuals who have done the, you know, buildings, places, who do the people who designed the places that that millions of, the whole arrays of people go to visit just to be there, just to be in the presence of the built environment. And those I use as illustrations, sketches throughout the essays, as you know. And, you know, things like places like Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres and the Spanish Steps and on and on. They are, and then you could take the whole period of in France from, you know, in the 12 and 1300s, 1400s to some extent, of building the, those cathedrals. I mean, the French cathedrals and to a lesser, and to some extent the British cathedrals, and the ones that I've studied, maybe it's true in Spain and Italy too, are do exactly are do build on a real understanding, maybe not articulated, well articulated, but a real understanding of human nature.
How so?
I'm taking well the idea of what one of the features of the human mind and body is transcendence. I mean, we are have so many limits on us: our energy, our strength, our minds. We have so many limits on us that we and so many ambitions that we're continually frustrated and imagine transcendence, transcending those limits. You walk into a cathedral, and boy, you do. In terms of both space, I mean, many things in terms of space, certainly in terms of light, the dazzling light of the windows, the
sure
colored windows, and also if you're there during a, I mean, the music and the way music fills those spaces, and the rituals, I mean, and supports the rituals. I mean, there's a profound understanding of human nature in those places. I mean, go on and on. Look at Chartres. I mean, Chartres has a story, and in the sculpture, there's a wonderful story about a political story about in the sculpture about. In fact, the building had a political purpose too, about who's in and who's out. And that, you know, so there are stories. That's only one of the stories woven through the cathedral. I mean, in addition to the stories of the Bible, the Old and New Testament, that are woven through the cathedral in the windows, of course, as well as the sculpture and stories, storytelling. We are born storytellers, Curtis, and so those stories add another level of. Another level of experience to virtually any great cathedral.
Do you think then that I want to step sideways for a moment back to the current time, where there's been a lot of what I see is flailing about over the issue of so-called modernism, where it seems that the modern spirit of the early 20th century, the progressive spirit, the let's make life better spirit, is a little flat in a couple of reasons. I want to get back to storytelling, that some modern buildings really don't tell a story. What do you think about that?
Well, again, in a later post, I'm going to write a little bit about the humanism in modernism. It's a narrow humanism. In modernism, I mean, the principal enterprise of modern culture is in the sciences, the development of of reliable, useful sciences, and that has resulted in us overcoming a lot of the limitations that I was talking about. I mean, we have transcended our strength, our eyesight,
our ability to move faster than 3 miles an hour, except on horseback.
All of those things, lighting and all of the ways we've transcended our senses and the limits of our poor little bodies, we have done, and it has been such a great achievement it's such a great achievement that has taken the mainstream of it's that part of our humanism that has become the mainstream of the way we think or design buildings. And so there is a real humanism in the modern design, but it's a narrow one based on those wonderful, glamorous improvements that we've made in our physical situation, our physical parameters.
But
go ahead.
I wanted to play devil's advocate here. I want you to understand that at my core, just so you know where this question is coming from, I do believe that a purpose of life is to improve the common experience of human life so that we can, and to use your word, transcend the ordinary. Take out the trash instead of having it pile up in the corner of our room, for example, to have clean air instead of having to breathe the fumes from our cooking fire and things like that, at a very basic level. But here's my devil's advocate sort of question. Haven't we fallen into being so enamored of our gadgets that for a while it was preferable to have an artificially produced wood grain panel for mica trim on a piece of furniture instead of the actual real piece of wood, because our artificially technologically created surface was conceived of as being more perfect than the natural product itself, and therefore we became so fixated on this notion of technology and universal science that we forgot the human connection to what was actually real.
And that a lot of
so-called modern architecture is only about what we can do because we can do it without any regard to whether it's any good.
Oh yeah, I think that's a very good point, Curtis. I think you put it in a good way, and I certainly agree that a major goal, ambition, that's driving us, and a major fundamental primal human value is improving our lives. But the point I was making, supplementing, is that in the modern culture, because we were so successful with the sciences, that they have that it's the human accomplishments in the sciences, in engineering and so on, are the ones we have let, or didn't let, we the ones that have taken over, and we're neglecting many other human values.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's what we're. I mean, that's another way I think of saying what you said. But and the gadgets, you know, that's a perfect example. We can do it, so we do it. but why is another reason, and why gets it? And that's why I call we're enamored of our machines, of our science, and you know, being in love with one girl, you can't sometimes can't be in love with another. So we've courted this the machines and lived with their and supported their creations because they've done such a great job for us.
Mm-hmm.
But they're limited. They're narrow.
Yeah.
Those values are narrow.
I read one of the comments to one of your early essays, and your reader said, come on, Bob, everybody knows that modernism is a failed revolution because it didn't really live up to its avowed goals of making life better. And from that, I would paraphrase that perhaps modernism was a failed revolution because of, in one part, because of the implied universality of a scientific reading of human behavior, which varies from culture to culture.
You made a couple of points that I'd like to comment on. Number one is I responded to that comment by saying that the modern revolution is going on. I mean, modern revolution is certainly not run its course. I mean, we're still trying to find new names. After we used the name new postmodern, we're struggling to find new names for what's going on now. But the modern revolution is going on and healthy, and it is an universality of scientific knowledge that we've gained is a factor in it. Is one of the factors which has its pros and cons, as you pointed out. But it is a fact. I mean that those are universal things, and I would add to that, and that we as human beings are universal. Now we do have differences because we all, you know, after the first humans left Africa, we all spread out and continued evolving in the places that we were. I mean, look at the difference between the Eskimos and you and me. And so we are all very different in many ways. However,
well, I don't know about you, Bob, but I like being cozy in the wintertime.
We're all very similar in ways. Look how similar we are. We're so similar. We have religions that are global. We have and ideologies that are global, and we have architecture. Like, say, the Taj Mahal or landscapes like the British landscapes, English estate landscapes, that are copied all over the world. The classical, the work of Greece and Rome, architecture of Greece and Rome, copied all over the world, if not literally, certainly in spirit. I mean, we are enough alike as human beings for that to take place. Look at the Taj Mahal. We don't understand. Most of the people who go there have no idea of the immense suffering that was, required to create that place. And so it's just that the scientific part, the universal sciences, because they've been so successful, we've exploited them so successfully, that we have, as I said, neglected all the other girls at the dance.
Yeah. One of my...
responding to your point?
All right. Yeah. Yes. I wanted to step sideways yet again,
yeah,
and express my own discontents with the received notion of the modern style, and as a jumping off point, the codification of the so-called international style of modernism, which, and you could pick, Ernst Mai's housing project, or any other project of the 1920s, it became codified by Hitchcock and Johnson in the early 30s, which was presented as a series of formal solutions, somewhat parenthetically posed as humanitarian interventions. I hate that word intervention, but in any case, I think it works here, to rid of us of old or unhealthy habits and modes of living. And I think we could say that sort of sentiment came to a climax in one way when Gropius built his own house in Massachusetts, and he had the open fireplace, which actually in that mode of thought could never be truly modern. It was a quaint anachronism to have an open flame when, in fact, you could have an electric heater. And it sort of became an art object as antique as someone's grandmother's Wedgwood china to have an open flame. So
you said you were going to talk about refuge later, but you've raised the issue right here.
fair enough.
The fireplace, the fire. I mean, we evolved alongside the control of fire. Let me put it this way: the control of fire affected how we did evolve. We did it together, and in an open house like wide open house, in a house using modern space concepts like Gropius.
Open plan, sure.
What?
Open plan, like Gropius' house.
Yeah, right. A fireplace is a symbol of refuge, of, you know, warmth and the cooking fire, all the associations that we evolved with fire. The hearth is a symbol of refuge that has has had a very long life. I mean, thousands of years of life. So it's not surprising that he would add that. Refuge is not just in architecture either. I mean, it's not just in architectural style. The modern styles generally, with the openness, open, airy, spacious places are very desirable, very pleasant places to be, but we still have a desire for a refuge, for the refuge and prospect, they go together. That's a common idea in the conventional idea in the profession, most of the profession, certainly the landscape profession.
I would argue that an open plan house is something that takes some getting used to, and perhaps was refreshing as a antidote to some 18th or 19th century system of organizing rooms. I personally, in my own experience as a young child, as children all are, I grew up in a ranch house, and we had a lot of open space. We had only clear story windows that worked perfectly for bringing in daylight. You couldn't actually see your neighbors from your room. You had to stand on a desk to see what was going out on the street. But it was sort of Frank Lloyd Wright prairie house, fourth time, fourth hand. I personally, at this point in life, would rather have a house that was a series of rooms enfilade, where you would pass from one to the next, interconnected but separate rather than an open plan. I would never want to live in a house like the Farnsworth house or Philip Johnson's glass house or, you know, something like the Barcelona Pavilion or even Tugendhat house. I would find that horrifying because I wouldn't feel a sense of containment, or for me, that wouldn't be refuge. So I'm not convinced that a open plan house is universally satisfying.
Well, you know, I don't think any specific planning concept is universally satisfying, but I think a point I'd like to respond to that point of where you grew up. first have your first are feeling, you know, strong emotions and make connections with people and make connections with the natural world. These places are imprinted on you, just like a people, your mother, the relationship of the mother and child is an imprinting going on. It goes on all through your childhood, and as you grow up, the places that that you experience, the places that you, you know, had your first victories, your first or first fears, those places stay with you in through your life. Now they change. You mature and they change, but they do stay with you. And you know from working with clients that that they can be very powerful remnants of their experience that are demands in a house. But I think it could be that you wouldn't want to live in an open plan house because of a sequence of rooms.
I'll grant you that, because at the same period of life for me, I spent most of my time outdoors, with backyards that were all interconnected, one big, vast experiment in having the backyard become almost a little village commons. Of course, that didn't last very long because our parents planted hedgerows instead of having fences. But for a while, it was a huge field behind, and across that field was another row of ranch houses. And we spent our days under the sky, either sledding, this is outside of Chicago, or on our bicycles. We spent all of our time out of doors. And when we came home, a house that was as open as being outdoors wasn't all that different. And so, yes, I will accept that I'm imprinted by my experience. Certainly my affection for cities probably comes from having learned to crawl on the grass in a public park in Chicago on the shores of Lake Michigan. And I'm always most comfortable living in a city that's on the edge of a great body of water.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's another whole subject that I'd love to get into. But let's stick with your
But what I'd like to get back to is seeds of ideas that I take away from what you've written in terms of looking to renew our involvement with behavioral inquiries. Because one thing that I think that early modern, I would say that modernism is an attitude, not a style. Would you agree with that?
Well, I wouldn't say an attitude. I would make that plural.
Okay. We can see what the different distinctions there might be. But one thing that we don't have yet from behavioral science, from psychology, from physiology, we don't have a toolkit quite yet. We have examples. We have models of things that we find pleasing. Quality of light, proportion of space. Not since the geometrists, starting with, say, Alberti, or Corbu, who wish to examine how certain geometrical relationships in plan, section, and elevation were pleasing, have we had a toolkit? But I think what you're suggesting, and something that I would endorse, is that we're now in a position to be able to use these scientific results from other branches of knowledge, not just purely architectural form making, as tools to make better buildings and better communities.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, I would say my purpose in organizing a bunch of ideas that I call a new humanism is to put together, in a sense, a toolkit of what we know now, of the knowledge that's out there now about human beings and why how humans experience architecture, why we respond to architecture and the landscapes and cities the way we do, and and a facet of that is of course geometry, and you mentioned Alberti and Corbusier, and I do get into that in a later post.
Good.
Get into that further. There's a feeling, which brings us to a little slightly different subject, a feeling that there is some deeper order of things. For millennia, there's been a feeling that there must be some deeper order of things, some cosmic order that we need to discover. I'm reading a book on that subject now that is not quite believable, because it refers to the knowledge of the people of Atlantis. There is a lot in the idea of there is some underlying, some deeper order of things, geometries are a part of that. In fact, you're familiar. Most architects are familiar with the Gestalt experiments, which show that. You tend to make geometric holes out of it, or you see lines or points, you tend to make geometric holes.
Sure.
Holes. Wholes. And that's well worth studying. Then there's also the golden section of the 1.6 blah 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 to 1 ratio that. You know, it keeps coming up in culture after culture as a beautiful, some would say the most beautiful form. There are a few examples of it in the natural world, but I think that there may well be things like proportions, and like geometries that that Alberti was working on, that like music. Like our appreciation of harmonies in music, are built into a human mind and body.
Exactly so.
That we haven't recognized yet because we haven't studied them yet.
Right.
We've seen evidence of it, Italian Renaissance. We've seen some great evidence of it, but I think one of the roles of a new humanism, of pulling all these tools together, is to discover what parallels we could find in vision that we to what we find with hearing, with sound. Because we have a sort of, it seems, instinctive appreciation of certain music in certain forms. Why don't we have, and we must have also in visual forms? I think that... new humanism, as I see it, a role of it is to discover those kinds of things, building on what we know now, and then make them instruments of design.
I myself would like to be able to have the time and the and the support, because I don't think I could do this myself, to study conditions of light. I'm aware that different frequencies of light, different luminosities and frequencies, you know, and you can even see this in movies, have an effect on human emotion. You can tell the difference between French light and Dutch light in a movie. You can definitely see the different qualities of light between New York City and Paris, for example. And the quality of light then that enters our brains, either out in the street or coming through the window of our house or our office, is something that we're just on the verge of being aware of affecting our happiness, our attentiveness, our ability to concentrate or to be able to cope with distractions. So I think you're on the right track here to set up criteria for other people to study. Is that one of your hopes?
Well, I can't. Yeah, I can't study everything. I hope you get funded. I think your idea is right. Is along the same lines I've been thinking, and I do try to outline in these blogs, blog posts. I do try to outline the basic biology, the basic human nature that you would start from, and then go from there. You mentioned light. Light is light and color, I think, which can do all of those things that you're talking about. I think are very much understudied. Now we do have some good science available in optics, the optic sciences, and you know, and we have a start there, but it really hasn't been, those things really haven't been put together in a way that we can apply them.
You're right. I mean, a lot of the things that we know about color theory.
Yeah, let's put that another way. One of the points of one of the themes of the new humanism ideas is that it's not that there aren't some great designers out there, but we need to educate the rest of us who are not a part of some elite, so that we can work up at that level. I mean, there are a lot of people who understand light and understand those things you're talking about and practice lighting designers who can do all of those things you're talking about. But they're a very small group, an elite, and the rest of us are not getting that kind of education. In fact, there are not enough of those lighting experts to go around, and we don't exploit the knowledge that's out there. And a part of what I mean by a new humanism is putting it together and exploiting it, starting with the science of it, understanding of architects, understanding the engineering of it. It's being exploited by the lighting industries, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not, the architects, designers are not using that knowledge that's out there, except, as I say, for a very small group.
I wouldn't even go so far as to say that the architectural elites are really designing with a full deck of cards. when I see a building that has a universal curtain wall, and they can't even make up their minds about where to put a window, and so instead put an entire wall of glass, and all that they're really contributing to the overall composition is an arrangement of geometric spacing of mullions, I think they're avoiding the issue of, to get back to Kahn, the argument of the room. What does each specific room want to be? How does it work? How does light really enter that room? I mean, they're leaving it to the decorators to decide where to put the drapes, and I think that's... I think that's a cheap way out, and yet people do it, and they're acclaimed. And I find the results rather myself disappointing, because they're not looking at why are things the way they are in terms of how they function in terms of our experience, but rather back to the gadget thing. They're doing it because they can.
Well, and we're doing it because it's fashionable. But I think that's something that architects have shortchanged themselves. There's a whole lot more that goes into the design decisions in a building than architects take on as their responsibility, and partly because they're not qualified. But there are, I mean, the curtain wall certainly has an economic component, not only in construction, but in the use of the space that's behind that curtain wall, the flexibility of the space. I mean, there's a cost-benefit factor in every design decision. I think, again...
But Bob, you know, I've been involved on a technical level with a lot of high-rise residential stuff, and curtain wall's not cheap. I mean, starting at $125 a square foot, and you could go up to $250. You could build a lot of other alternative kinds of enclosures and still have it be a pleasing building and still give a sense of refuge for less money. Then there's the speed of erection and all that kind of stuff. And then there's also the popular understanding. You said fashionable. Let's get back to that. A certain fashion for a certain kind of look without anybody actually thinking about what are we doing, why are we doing it, does it make the people who live there happy? These are questions that don't really come up. A lot of architects will defer to the brokers who have to sell these individual apartments.
And all again, an economic issue.
Yeah. So I think that what you've done here is a wonderful way to reawaken our senses what are we really trying to accomplish as architects?
And decide what we want to accomplish by understanding better the people we're designing for.
I could not agree more. I think that's fantastic. You know, an hour goes really quickly. I think we've just about come up to the end of our allotted time. I've been speaking with Robert Lamb Hart, who is principal or founder of Hart Howerton. I think I know somebody who works in or has worked in your New York office, Kate Bakewell, who's a landscape architect.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, Kate's been a guest a couple times.
Projects with Kate, sure.
Yeah, Kate's been here on this program, and I'm glad that I'm glad that you were able to join us. And after you get a few more. Broadsides across the bow out there, I'm sure that I'll want to speak with you again, and I hope that you will be able to join us again.
Yeah, I hope so. Sure, give me a call.
Absolutely. Sure. Thank you so much for joining our little radio experiment, our tribe here at Heritage Radio Network. And if you ever come or find yourself next in New York City, I do hope that you'll come out and join us here in the studio. It's been Burning Down the House for 20th of January 2013. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Keep the faith in keeping it better and better. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.